This is Monitor. Ben Grauer speaking and happy to come aboard. One of the many fine things that TV offers every Sunday afternoon is Meet the Press, a program wherein persons currently in the news meet newsmen in a novel conference with the nation listening in. Now, right at this moment in a Washington television studio, James B. Conant, United States Ambassador to the newly formed West German Republic, is taking his place before four top-flight Washington reporters, gentlemen of whom it might well be said they have many questions, but few illusions. Ambassador Conant will be questioned about official reaction to the bid of the Soviet Union to normalize, well, that's the expression they use, to normalize their relations with West Germany. Asking the questions are Eli Abel, New York Times, John Hightower of the Associated Press, Miss Marguerite Higgins, New York Herald Tribune, and Lawrence Spivak of NBC. Presiding as moderator is Ned Brooks. Before we join Meet the Press and Ambassador Conant, here are some top news stories, particularly in connection with the Meet the Press discussion which we're going to hear. West German Chancellor Konrad Adenauer is flying the Atlantic tonight. He's due in Washington tomorrow. He'll talk with President Eisenhower and Western Big Three foreign ministers. One likely topic of conversation is the invitation of Soviet leaders for Mr. Adenauer to visit Moscow. Other talks are going on right now behind closed doors in Detroit. General Motors officials and chiefs of the CIO United Auto Workers are searching for a peace formula. They want to reach a contract agreement before a strike deadline at midnight tonight. The main issue is the guaranteed annual wage. There's labor trouble in Singapore, too. Threat of a general strike led the local British Crown Colony government to arrest five Chinese trade union leaders. The local government, in leftist hands, was said to believe that the trade union leaders were communist-inspired. Far from curbing the threatened paralysis, the arrest resulted in inciting a new strike action. This one halted operation of 10 Singapore bus lines. And UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld announced today that former President Harry S. Truman will address the 10th anniversary session of the United Nations on Friday night, June 24th, at San Francisco. Former President Truman had refused an earlier invitation to attend the San Francisco meeting, an invitation from the State Department. Later on this evening, we're expecting a Monitor report of special interest from Buenos Aires, a report on an anti-church demonstration there. Yesterday, a new peak was reached in the bitterness between church and state. Police banned a procession of Corpus Christi worshippers. The Peron government and pro-Peron newspapers said that yesterday's Catholic marches were incited by the clergy to burn the Argentine flag, to stone newspaper offices and public buildings, and attack foreign embassies. That Monitor report from Buenos Aires. Now I see the program's just beginning. So Monitor monitors the best of TV to Washington and Meet the Press, where we'll meet Eli Abel, John Hightower, Margaret Higgins, Lawrence Spivak, Ned Brooks, and the guest, Ambassador Conant.
Welcome once again to Meet the Press. The attention of the world centers today on Germany. The proposed rearming of West Germany has produced a dramatic countermove by Russia, the invitation to Chancellor Adenauer to visit Moscow to discuss the resumption of diplomatic and trade relations. Dr. Adenauer at this moment is flying to the United States for important conferences with President Eisenhower and Secretary of State Dulles. And our own ambassador to West Germany, Dr. James B. Conant, has just flown to Washington. Our guest today is Dr. Conant. He has been observing these momentous developments on the international scene at close range. Dr. Conant is one of the world's leading scientists. He played an important part in the development of the atomic bomb and in the later efforts to outlaw its use. He is known as a great chemist, a teacher, the former president of Harvard University. He became High Commissioner to Germany in 1953, and this year, when Germany was admitted to full partnership with the West, he became our first post-war ambassador. And now seated around the press table, ready to interview Ambassador Conant, are John Hightower of the Associated Press, Marguerite Higgins of the New York Herald Tribune, Ellie Abel of the New York Times, and Lawrence Spivak, our regular member of the Meet the Press panel. And now, Mr. Ambassador, if you're ready, we'll start the questions with Mr. Abel.
Mr. Ambassador, the President paid a handsome tribute last week to Dr. Adenauer as a statesman who wouldn't forsake his friends and allies in whatever negotiations he might have with the Russians. Isn't there, however, some reason to suspect that many millions of ordinary Germans who want to see their country unified will bring tremendous and perhaps irresistible pressures on their government to deal with the Russians directly on unification?
I would very glad to answer that question, say that I'm sorry I can't agree with you in your suspicion in regard to what pressures would be brought on the Chancellor. I think that we can have confidence not only in the Chancellor, but in his advisors, in the government, the people around him, to be sure that whatever they do in regard to the best interests of Germany will also be in the best interests of the free world.
Well, we're not suggesting, Mr. Ambassador, I didn't mean to suggest, a lack of confidence in Dr. Adenauer. But isn't it true that the Russians have some very high cards to play here, that there are certain things they have to give the Germans that we can't do? For example, the return of prisoners or of the Oder-Neisse territories?
Well, if I may take those questions up in the reverse order, as far as the Oder-Neisse territory is concerned, as you're well aware, we've taken the position, and all the parties in the Bundestag have taken the position, that a freely elected all German government must be free to decide the boundaries of future Germany. So that question doesn't come up for consideration at this time. Till the Russians are ready to allow free elections and a freely formed all German government. In regard to the prisoners in Russia, they have already let some out. Undoubtedly, that will be a matter of discussion.
Mr. Spivak.
Dr. Conant, there's been some question as to when Chancellor Adenauer will go to Moscow. Can he go to Moscow before the meeting of the Big Four without more or less torpedoing the Big Four meeting?
Well, I think you'll have to ask Chancellor Adenauer the question of when he's going. He's, after all, going to be here tomorrow and gives you a good chance.
No, but I'm asking, sir, your opinion as to what does happen if he does go.
Would make a great deal of difference under the conditions under which he went and what he said when he got there and the various negotiations that were then published. I shouldn't want to prejudge the question now of when he could go.
Well, do you know, sir, whether or not the Big Four are going to spend a good deal of their time on the question of Germany? Isn't that one of the major purposes of the Big Four meeting?
As I understand, the purpose of the meeting, as it's been called at the summit, as we say in German, on the highest level, is for the purpose of exploring ways and means of solving problems, not to consider specific problems themselves.
Well, may I ask you this question? If Adenauer does go to Moscow, doesn't he establish the precedent of unilateral dealing, whereas up until now, bilateral dealing with Russia, whereas up until now, the Big Four have discussed the German question?
Well, up until May 5th, 1955, the Federal Republic of Germany was in an occupation status. Since May 5th, 1955, the Federal Republic of Germany has been a sovereign nation, and I have become, as is just stated by our presiding officer here, an ambassador and not the High Commissioner. Therefore, the situation is not comparable to what goes on in the future and in the past.
Miss Higgins.
I'd like to get at American policy. What is America's asking price for a settlement in Europe? Would America be willing to see Western troops taken out of Germany, providing Russia lives up to its wartime agreements and has free elections in Eastern Europe?
You're asking me too many questions, I'm afraid, all at once, and you're asking me as though I were either the President or the Secretary of the State, where I only have the honor to be the President's representative in Federal Republic of Germany. But let me try to give you my answer, if I can, to what I think is the basis of your question. It seems to me that as long as the world remains in its present divided condition, that surely the United States is going to keep its troops in Europe. That has been repeatedly said by the President, first in connection with the EDC treaties and the Paris treaties. Seems to me until there's a revolutionary change in the whole situation, and we can count on a fact that we don't have to have a strong regional defense against threats from the Soviet Union, until such a time may come, surely we must remain strong in Europe, and that would mean troops essentially where they are.
What I'm trying to get at is we must look at the future in some definite point. The Russians are coming up with concrete proposals. Now, if they are prepared to get out of Eastern Europe, the Russians, if they live up to their wartime agreements, America doesn't want to keep its troops forever overseas, would that be a basis of discussion, a reasonable point of settlement on which we could have German reunification and evacuation by America of its bases overseas.
You were speaking of the Russians taking their troops out of not only the Soviet zone, but all the so-called satellites.
Living up to its wartime
pledges. Well, if you imagine a situation in which the whole status of the satellites, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the other countries, it's totally different from what it is now. If you imagine a whole new revolutionary climate of opinion, then I'm not prepared to make any predictions as to what our policy would be.
That's
something very different. Surely it's a basis for discussion, but I'd like to just quibble on that point. A basis for discussion is not the same thing as a basis for settlement.
Mr. Hightower.
Dr. Conant, there's so much interest in the Russian invitation to Dr. Adenauer. I wonder if you would suggest some of the considerations that would enter into whether he should go or not go. I don't mean that to discuss it from the point of view of what the German government should decide, but what are the forces which are at work on the decision in this case?
Well, of course, I'm sure you don't want me as an ambassador credited to his country to presume to speculate on what may be going through the Chancellor's mind. I take it rather you would like to have me just report on the various forces
That's
at
right.
work in Germany
yeah.
today, not so much on the reference to this particular question of his timing of his visit, whether he makes a visit and what he says, but on the whole question you've all been exploring here, the question of reunification, which is
yes,
both so complicated and so important to the Germans, and so important, if I may say so, to the people of the United States.
That's right.
Well, clearly, as you know, the parties in the Bundestag, not only the parties in the Chancellor's coalition, but the opposition, seem to be agreed on the following points. In the first place, that whatever when reunification comes, it must come not through force, but in peace and in freedom. That's the phrase they repeat so often, all of them. In the second place is that it must come through free elections through all of Germany, creating a new all-German government. And third, that this new all-German government must be free to decide its own place and its own role in Europe.
Now, in the process of the unification of Germany, if it ever reaches that point, what are the relative strengths and weaknesses of West Germany and East Germany?
You mean in terms of their adherence to the free world and the democratic way of life?
Well, I'd say in terms of their adherence to the ideologies which dominate them at the present time, that is, and in terms of the size of the population and natural wealth and political stability.
Well, if I may just for the sake of the audience repeat what I'm sure you're well aware of, the Federal Republic of Germany, this sovereign nation, which was composed of the British, French, and American zones until May 5th, that's 50 million people, some 18 million in the Soviet zone. We've got Berlin in this very special position. Now, the people in the 18 million zone, Soviet zone, are present living under the domination of a puppet regime, the so-called German Democratic Republic, tool of Moscow completely. One can't say for certain what they think, but all the evidence indicates that if you had free elections under conditions of free discussion tomorrow in the Soviet zone, I don't believe you'd poll more than 5 to 20% at the most, probably around 10% votes for the communist regime.
Well, sir, the unbalance is so great that I wondered whether you were aware of any speculation or theorizing in Germany that perhaps behind this Soviet invitation to the Chancellor was some maneuver on their part eventually to scuttle the East German government, simply to recognize the West as the stronger force and deal with it in a practical way.
Well, of course, that's one alternative. One can think of several alternatives, and I don't want to choose between them because it doesn't seem to me very profitable to speculate on what the may be going through the minds of the people in the Kremlin, but clearly one of them might be what you say. But another one might be just the reverse, that they might be interested in developing their relations with Bonn and still keep them with Pankow.
Mr. Abel.
Mr. Ambassador, I'm not going to ask you to speculate either, but I would like your observations on a point that interests me considerably. The Big Four, evidently at Geneva, if that's the place, are going to begin to talk disarmament, or at least some new approach to limitation of forces on either side of the Iron Curtain. In view of the fact that the Germans have not yet armed, but have only taken a commitment to arm. Does your embassy, do your fact finders there find that that the imminence of this disarmament effort is perhaps helping the forces, strengthening the forces that oppose speedy German rearmament?
I wouldn't think so, as you know, but again, our audience may not, that the split in Germany is on party lines. The coalition parties, all the parties in the Bundestag except the Social Democrats, have been solidly behind the rearmament, first under the form of EDC, and then under the alternative worked out, the so-called Paris treaties. The opposition has been against both, and since that's on a straight party line basis, I don't think that these forthcoming four-pause talks have much effect one way or the other.
Do you rule out a segment of independent or nonpartisan opinion?
As far as the actual voting in the Bundestag is concerned, yes, because the Bundestag, as you know, and European votes pretty much on party lines. If you're talking about the electorate, I'd point out that the best test you've got of it most recently is the election in Rhine-Pfalz, where, in spite of heavy campaigning by the opposition against the Chancellor's own party did as well or a little better than ever before. Mr. Spivak.
Dr. Conant, on June 30th of 53, the reliable New York Times quoted you as saying that the government, the United States government, would reject any Soviet proposal for a high-level four-power conference to solve the German problem unless Moscow was prepared to end its dictatorial control of East Germany and accept in advance Germany's reunification on the terms outlined in the Allied Note of September 1952. Now, do you expect that to happen, or have we changed our policy about the four-power conference?
I think that four-power conference, this was before the Berlin Conference, this statement was in, now what's the date?
It was June 30th, 1953.
Yes, that's before the Berlin Conference some time. After all, a good deal of water has gone under the bridges since then. And we were talking then about a possible four-power conference aimed directly at the German reunification problem. What I was stating there in advance was essentially the position which we took at the Berlin Conference. And let me point out, it was a position that was endorsed by all the parties in the Bundestag. I gave it a moment ago. Opening up of the Soviet zone so that you can have the conditions for free elections. Free elections of an all-German government. An all-German government free to settle its own position in the affairs in the place in Europe and negotiate the peace treaty.
Well, do you foresee any possibility as a result of what's going to happen that they may withdraw from East Germany?
Well, I'm not going to, again, speculate too far in the future. And as I understand it, the first step in this four-power conference at the summit, as you call it, in the highest level, will be to work out procedures and what those procedures will be for handling the different problems, disarmament, reunification of Germany, I don't know. And when we come to a point where we're going to talk again, as we did in Berlin specifically, about German reunification, I'll be in a better position to answer your question.
I tried to get you to speculate a bit on the future because you did such a good job once before. I have picked up a quote of yours way back in 1951 in which you predicted that by the middle of the 1950s, we would have a balanced force at the disposal of the Atlantic Treaty nations. And you said at the time it would be clear to Moscow that there could be no easy march to the Channel. And this is also what you said, and I quote your words exactly. When that day comes, the fear of a communist aggression will cease to haunt Western Europe. And when that day comes, one can begin to talk about a real settlement of the international situation. Now, you foresaw it then. Do you still foresee a real settlement of the international situation?
Thank you. I appreciate the implied compliment of being quoted when I was a fairly accurate...
This is only to get you to speculate again.
I appreciate you. I appreciate the gambit. Thank you very much. Well, I'd like to say in this that the basis for any speculation about the future must be a premise. And the premise is that the free world, and particularly the United States, stays in as strong a posture as I predicted it would in 1951. And if you will assume that the free world stays as strong and that we go ahead with our strength...
Well, do you believe that we are now in a better position to expect a real settlement in Europe than we have been for a long time?
A better settlement on terms of peace and freedom. I can subscribe entirely to the point of view which the Chancellor has said so often, and it's been said by our government as well, that until Germany became an integrated part, the Federal Republic of the free nations, the Western European structure, until that time, the danger was that Germany might be unified, but not on our terms, but on the Russian terms. which is neither peace nor freedom.
Mr. Ambassador, you worked with the United Nations on atomic control. Do you see any better chance now than when you tried it before and didn't get very far?
Well, I hate to dodge a question or not answer it, but I really haven't had a chance to follow those negotiations at all. Fred, I've left what knowledge I had of atomic energy behind me, trying to pick up some information about Germany and the international scene in Europe.
Miss Higgins.
Mr. Ambassador, we say we're against a neutral Germany. Would you foresee, is it a United States policy that a unified Germany be part of NATO?
Let me, first of all, pick up that first question, if I may, because you rather implied that we were against a neutralized Germany, but the Germans might be for it, and I want to be put the record straight on that, if I may, that all the parties in the Bundestag, including the socialist opposition, have said repeatedly in the last few weeks that they were opposed to neutralization, too. Therefore, I think that makes it unanimous. Yes. Now, if you don't have a neutralized Germany, in all Germany, in the usual sense of that word, then the question of the place of that all-German government in the future of Europe will depend, surely, on the kind of Europe which then exists.
Do you think we can have a German settlement, Mr. Ambassador, apart from a general European settlement, including Eastern Europe?
No, I think you'll have to have it as part of a total situation which will develop in the world.
Do you believe that Chancellor Adenauer will be able to go ahead with his plans for arming Western Germany, that there will be no halt called pending negotiations and talks with the Russians?
I feel quite certain of it. I feel certain that the German government will live up to its pledges which it took in signing the Paris treaties.
What are the best things that the United States could do, from your personal point of view, to assist Germany towards this goal of reunification? Concrete proposals we can make?
To keep on doing all we can through diplomatic channels and all we can in statements that are made by our representatives to repeat what we honestly believe, namely that it is of the greatest importance to the United States government and the American people that Germany be reunited, that it be of greatest importance that we continue to support Berlin, not only as an outpost of freedom, about which we're very proud because of their brave stand the blockade, but as the future capital of a united Germany.
Mr. Hightower.
Dr. Conant, in the background of all these political and even the military questions is the problem of trade always. What is happening in trade between West Germany and the Eastern Bloc countries?
Well, there is a certain amount of trade going on in non-strategic items. The strategic items are controlled by international agreement, as you know. But as I talk to the people in Germany who are concerned with trade and industry, the people in the famous Ruhr area, I don't think that they feel that there's any great possibility there of enormous openings for trade. After all, the whole question of trade between East and West is frightfully complicated from an economic as well as from a political point of view. Well, present, the German trade is doing very well in other areas, as you know.
Their economy is such that they are not dependent on it, then, for a further expansion?
Not to any appreciable degree, not to an enormous degree, let us put that. Well, I sometimes read that there's this great pressure from the industrialists to open up trade with the Russian group. I don't find that. I don't think that corresponds to any prevailing sentiment.
Mr. Spivak.
Dr. Conant, there's been some speculation here that we might consent to neutralization of Germany if the Russians consent to neutralization of the satellite states. Do you see any possibility of that?
I don't. It doesn't seem to me that's a profitable line of speculation, quite frankly, at this time, and I think it tends to confuse the issue because, from my point of view, this has been expressed by many members of the Chancellor's government, a neutralized Germany, unless you have a revolutionarily changed world situation, is a Germany that couldn't protect itself.
We have then, and this you should know, a clear policy on Germany today, haven't we?
We have a clear policy, and as far as the unification of Germany is concerned, it's the same policy it was in the Berlin conference.
And we're determined that Germany must remain a member of NATO?
The Federal Republic of Germany, certainly is we not insisting on it, but we assume that the Germans will insist on it because it's a question of a treaty agreement that they've made. There's no question in our mind but what the Federal Republic of Germany will honor its treaty obligations, which is to be an active partner of NATO. We are both now.
And are we willing to make any concessions at all to the Russians for free elections in all of Germany? Have we any to make?
Well, I think that we have the general point of view that may be represented at any discussions that go on about the total world situation and disarmament, but I don't think they would be coupled directly on this position. I think our position would be as it was in Berlin in regard to the issue of reunification.
Miss Higgins.
Would a phased withdrawal of both Western and Soviet occupation troops be a reasonable basis for reuniting Germany and holding elections?
It wouldn't from my point of view.
Would it from the German point of view?
I would doubt it.
Do you feel that neutralism in this country, in Germany, has been misunderstood and misrepresented in this country?
Well, now, I haven't been in this country enough to know what's been said and how much it's been represented, and I shouldn't want to cast any aspersions on the press, you know, particularly on this occasion about representations, but it could be misrepresented, it could be misinterpreted, that I feel quite sure.
If the Russians say to Dr. Adenauer, we'll take our troops out of the Soviet zone of Germany, we are willing to have free elections if you can get the Western allies out of Western Germany. Will he be able to resist such a proposal?
I'm sure that I don't want to speculate on what the Chancellor will do under any different condition, set of, in any particular set of conditions, but I can't imagine that any German government, which is likely to be in office in the near future, is going to agree to any proposition by which the American troops go back to Europe, go back out of Europe, before there is a very revolutionary change in the European situation
could
in regard to the danger of Soviet aggression.
Could he unilaterally make such agreements with any kind of an agreement about Germany with the Russians without violating his international agreements with the West?
I'm not an international lawyer, but I can't imagine that he'd want to, because after all, his problem would be to get the conditions for a free election.
Dr. Conan, I'm very sorry I'm going to have to interrupt, but our time is up. Thank you very much, Ambassador. Yes, it does. It certainly does. Thank you very much, Ambassador Conan, for being with us. And now here is our announcer.
This again is Monitor, and you've been listening to something still rather new in radio. It's called a simulcast. Meet the Press, a top-ranking television program out of Washington at this time each Sunday. And the guest today was, as you heard, Ambassador James B. Conan, U.S. Ambassador to newly formed West German Republic. Henry Cabot Lodge will be the guest next week. Do be with us. Now, incidentally, Bob and Ray will be around all evening on Monitor. Henry Morgan will drop in with his monitoring of TV. So will Marilyn Monroe. That's good news for everybody. Bob Hope and a host of ladies and gentlemen who will make Monitor news. Stay with us, and stay with us particularly at this moment, because if you were watching our simulcast an hour or so ago, you saw a TW plane take off for England. By now, she's, I'd guess, about 300 or more miles out to sea. Let's monitor an Atlantic crossing by air to the TWA flight somewhere over the Atlantic. Come in, Star of Massachusetts.
Well, this is TWA Flight 860. We are now far out over the Atlantic Ocean, and we're going to interview a passenger here. Jim Cahill is walking down the aisle now, and Jim, who's he got for us?
We have flying with us today, Mrs. Mary King of Dartmouth in Devon, England, who is returning home after 5 weeks in the United States. Tell us, please, the occasion for your visit, Mrs. King.
The occasion for my visit was to see my sister, who had not seen for over 20 years. And it is through the kindness of Mr. Dick Hedberg, Mr. George Bright, a Bright Sword, and Mr. Ron Morgan, who arranged a free trip to me to meet my sister on Mother's Day, the 7th of May.
Fine. Thank you, Miss King, and thank you, Jim. You're winging your way happily, as we've heard, and we here in Monitor in Radio Central will be looking in on you as the evening progresses. That's Monitor. Stay with us throughout the rest of the afternoon, if it's afternoon in your part of the country, and the evening as we go through our first Monitor Day.
This is Monitor, the new NBC radio service.
This is Monitor, and this is time for Sammy Davis, Jr.
Love me or leave me or let me be lonely. You won't believe me, but I love you only. I'd rather be lonely than happy with somebody else. You might find the nighttime the right time for kissing, but nighttime is my time for just reminiscing, regretting instead of forgetting with somebody else. Now there'll be no one unless that someone is you, you, you. I intend to be independently blue, blue, blue. I want your love, but I don't want to borrow. Have it today, give back tomorrow. More love for my love, it's your love for nobody else. Saba doo ba doo the ooh, ooh.
This is Monitor, reporting the nation and the world. In the next hour, we'll go behind the bars of San Quentin Prison, travel to London on a constellation, hear Dixieland music from Nick's in Greenwich Village, visit backstage, with Mary Martin and Helen Hayes, go to press with the Chicago Sun-Times, interview Victor Borger, Bob Hope, and Gregory Rathoff, and much more. On hand is Monitor's major pickup, a report from inside the maximum security prison of San Quentin. It's now lockup time, and for the latest hourly report, Monitor goes to Walter McGraw in San Quentin Prison.
Of all the prisons in the United States, probably the most colorful is San Quentin. Before me are the blue waters of San Pablo Bay, a beautiful view broken only by the sight of a guard tower in front of me. As I turn around, there's the huge gate of San Quentin. First, a wooden door is slid open. This is the first thing that greets a new man. From here on, the gates are of steel. This one, basket weave steel. It clangs shut. The other gate, the one in front of me, the solid steel gate, cannot open until the other one is closed. To my left is the receiving room. There a new prisoner is brought in. There a body receipt is given for him. Going through the solid steel gate, you step into a sight that is almost unbelievable, especially to a man coming to prison. A garden, roses, flowers of every description. How actually does a man feel when he comes to San Quentin for the first time? To find out, Peg McGraw is talking to a man in the classification office.
You're new in here, aren't you?
Yes.
And what were you sent up for?
Armed robbery.
And for how long?
A 10-year minimum.
How did you feel when you found out that you were going to be sent to San Quentin?
Well, I felt repressed because I was scared of San Quentin prison. I've heard many stories about it. And I dreaded it. Didn't know what to do. I felt lost. I knew it was a new world to me, and I had to change my life over.
How did you feel when you first walked through these big doors here?
Well, I felt as though sometimes when I was a child, if I left my mother for a period of a day, I felt real glad to see her again, and it's the same thing in here. You leave your free life on the outside, you know you're going against a bunch of convicts, supposedly mean, and it kind of frightens a person.
And then how did you feel after you'd been in San Quentin for some time and found out the kind of institution it really is?
Well, I was overjoyed in a way because actually it's not a prison. It's more or less an institution where a person, if they study, they can get anything they want.
I'm out again in the garden, right next to the sally port that we came through a couple of moments ago. Standing beside me is Warden Teets. Tell me, Warden, what is that old building over there to my left?
The last remaining of the old Spanish cell blocks, built in 1852 and still in use due to the excess of population here.
Who uses it?
Second tier of that building is housed what we call our senior citizens, a group of men who have been here many years and, interestingly perhaps to you, carry the keys to their own cells.
That's interesting. When did San Quentin begin? When was it founded?
The story goes that the first state prisons were housed in 1851 on a prison ship which was moored in Vallejo. During a storm, the ship broke loose from its moorings and ran aground here on Point San Quentin.
You're lucky it chose such a beautiful spot.
It is nice here.
San Quentin has always meant, despite the beauty of the place, which is obvious, the word itself has always meant prison. It's meant tough prison, harsh prison. I think it's famed in story and legend for that. It seems to have changed quite a bit. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I think the prison of yesteryear was probably exemplified by Jack London, graphically told in the Star Rover, which was published in 1914, a body prisoner at San Quentin. But in the last few years, we have come to realize that you must have more than imprisonment. We know that 98 out of each 100 men go out. Those men who come to prison in the United States go out eventually. So that we must do more than just keep them. We must treat and correct them while we have them with us here.
What about the criticism that we're making country clubs out of our prisons?
That is not true. This institution, as you may have observed, is run very strictly, and we use discipline itself as treatment, as training.
In other words, the custody features are fitted right into the treatment.
They're a part of it. We do our best to coordinate and pull together our training and treatment functions. We believe that our officers apply a lot of treatment.
In 1 hour, we'll be talking to you from the mess hall. Meanwhile, this is Walter McGraw reporting to Monitor in San Quentin.
That was Monitor's report from San Quentin. Another in an hour. This is Ben Grauer in New York.
And this is Frank Gallup in Radio Central.
And this is Bob and Ray.
Well, these are Bob and Ray. Let's go someplace.
The world is before us, gentlemen. Rome, Tibet, an igloo interview from Alaska, a canoe trip up the Amazon.
Oh, wait a minute, Frank. See, I just have the one shirt here with me.
And but a single paddle, too.
How about Grant's Tomb or some quiet place like that?
Well, would you settle for a visit to the New York home of Dixieland music?
Oh, just what I had in mind. You refer to Nick's.
You mean where Jimmy McPartland and his genial tutors are ecstasizing music lovers and dazing tourists?
The very same, gentlemen. Monitor's advance man, Fred Collins, is waiting. So, for the next 5 minutes, we go to Nick's in New York and the Monitor music of Jimmy McPartland.
Here we are. Thank you very much. And here's Jimmy McPartland.
Good afternoon, Fred, and good afternoon, folks. For our first number, we're going to kick off a Dixieland tune called A Royal Garden Blues.
Go, Jimmy.
Hey, Fred.
Yes, indeed.
That was real great. This is your old pal Ray here at Radio Central. And we enjoyed that very much, right, Bob?
Sure did, and good to see you again, Fred. I hear you.
Well, bless your hearts, and everyone is having such a wonderful time here at Nick's. And I'd like you guys to meet a very dear buddy of mine, Jimmy McPartland.
And what does he play, the electric organ?
Tell him, Jimmy.
That's right. It's electric cornet I have down here, Ben.
Sounds good here, Jimmy.
No, it's Bob and Ray, Jim.
Oh, is it? Bob and Ray. Sorry, Bob.
We were cut off there for a minute.
Yeah, that's right, Fred. No, we're not cut off. We're right here in the communication center of the universe, and we won't get cut off, believe me.
Jimmy, what's next up on your list down there?
The next number?
Yeah.
Well, Freddie, what do you think about this tune we're going to play next?
Well, everybody down at Nick's always hollers for the Saints come marching in, so this would be a good time for it, Jimmy.
And that's what it's going to be, fellas.
Good. Thank you.
saints come marching in. Man, I'm gonna be blowing in that number when the saints come marching in. When the saints,
when the saints,
when the saints come marching in.
Now
I'm gonna be blowing on my cornet when the saints come marching in.
Along with Bob and Ray, we've been monitoring the music of Jimmy McPartland, broadcast from the courtesy, through the courtesy of the American Federation of Musicians, James C. Petrillo, President.
This is Monitor, going places and doing things. Take one. This is Monitor, and this is Ben Grauer. We've been to San Quentin Prison and to Nick's for Dixieland Music. And for the next 3 minutes, Monitor will go to the city desk of the Chicago Sun-Times to catch a news story coming in. Come along to a Monitor remote in Chicago and John Chancellor.
The sanctum sanctorum of any big metropolitan daily newspaper is the city room. Here's where the news report is carved and polished out of the raw and rough forms of the day's unprocessed news. The eye of this editorial hurricane is the city desk, and that's where Monitor is now, at the city desk of the Chicago Sun-Times. The morning paper, the first edition is called A Bulldog in Chicago, has just come up, and the presses six floors below us are rolling out the press run. The lead story here in Chicago is slugged GM, General Motors. Donald Schwartz, the Sun-Times staff man in Detroit, has a Dateline story saying General Motors and union negotiators appear to have averted a General Motors strike in a bargaining session that reportedly brought agreement on a guaranteed wage. This is getting top play in the first edition. Other local stories include a piece by reporter Carl Larson on Cook County's new sheriff, Joseph Lohman. Sheriff Lohman, it seems, is worried about 1,200 deputy sheriff badges held by the citizens of the county distributed by his predecessor. To sum up the sheriff's attitude in a quote, he says, "I want those I gotta drag badges returned to my office." We are sitting here in the chair of Karen Walsh, city editor of the Sun-Times, and across the desk sits James Penniff, the assistant city editor who's running the show this afternoon. Jim, I wonder if you'd tell us what other stories are in the works.
Well, John, most Sundays are a lot newsier than this one. The Weather Bureau tells us that the 9-day rainy spell we've had here is just about over, for one thing. A Chicago traffic cop was struck by a hit-and-run driver while writing out a ticket for another motorist standing alongside of his car. Hold it a minute, will you? KSD 542 to 324. Come in.
Clean up on the sports assignments.
Okay, Larry, come on in.
The city desk is in direct shortwave communication with its reporters and photographers. What you just heard was a photographer checking in at the end of an assignment. The receiver and transmitter is located right on the city desk, a few inches from Jim Penniff's right hand. One of the things Monitor will do in the coming weeks is sample the editorial opinions of big regional newspapers like the Sun-Times. Recently, at a party in Belgrade, a special Sun-Times correspondent named Frank Kelly had a talk with the Kremlin's Khrushchev, a talk that got him a visa to Moscow. What does the Sun-Times say of this? We quote, "To mix a metaphor, it might be said that vodka has helped to oil Russia's international relations. The vodka in question was imbibed by Communist Party boss Nikita Khrushchev at a five-hour party winding up the Russo-Yugoslav talks in Belgrade." And at this party, it was where correspondent Kelly got his visa. Of course, it doesn't necessarily follow that if the overlords of the Kremlin went on a mass spree, that peace would automatically break out all over, says the Sun-Times. It could turn out that a few of them are ugly drunks who might want to start shooting up the world just for kicks. That's this morning's editorial from the Sun-Times. When I used to work here at the city desk, one of the rewrite men used to tell me, these stories would make the best novel in the world if you could only give them continuity. We can agree and add that Monitor will have a go at supplying some continuity. This is John Chancellor, now back to Monitor and Radio Central in New York.
Thank you, John Chancellor. Monitor has been visiting a great newspaper as it prepares for press time. For the next 5 minutes and 30 seconds, we'll go backstage at the Belasco Theater here in New York, where two great stars, Helen Hayes and Mary Martin, are preparing for an appearance in France. On June 25th, they open at the historic Sarah Bernhardt Theater in Paris as part of the United States' contribution to the Paris Festival of Arts. For a backstage look, Monitor's reporter Al Capstaff is visiting the rehearsal of Thornton Wilder's Skin of Our Teeth. Miss Martin, are you very excited about this cultural pilgrimage?
I am, aren't you?
I should say so.
Miss Martin, have you ever appeared on the stage in Paris before this?
No, I haven't.
Helen, have you?
No, but I'm surprised that you haven't. I thought that people who could sing and dance had, you know, could play everywhere, and that I was never going to get to play in places that spoke another language.
But you've both been there, of course.
Oh, yes. Mm.
Yes, many times. Of course, your trip is under the auspices of Salute to France.
It was just got up for this, you know. The Salute to France is new this year, and the anti-organization was asked by the State Department to send some representation of the American theater to the Paris Festival of Arts, because it was held last year for the first time, the Paris Festival of the Arts, and all other countries practically in the world sent theater representation except the United States, and that was embarrassing to me.
Miss Martin, I was talking to your daughter, Helen, backstage a few minutes ago. I understand that she has a part in the play, and she's going to Paris with you, too.
Yes, she's playing Helen's daughter.
And I see.
Helen's son is in the play, too.
Wonderful. Mm-hmm. And your son, Jamie, is also connected with the company, isn't he?
Yes, he's going to be, I think, in the technical end.
Wonderful.
Backstage.
Well, uh-huh. That's a good business to follow in this theater, don't you think? We know that you have already won an Oscar in the motion picture field, but have you ever won a television Emmy?
Yes, I won that about 2 or 3 years ago.
For what part did you win?
Well, it was for, you know, for overall. I think I did about 3 performances for that season.
Yeah.
And it was for generally for all of them.
Yes. Do you like working in television?
I love all new adventures, and now I've done it enough to not have a new adventure anymore, and I'm not as keen about it as I was at first. I always come back to the theater,
yes.
And it's the one I like the best.
Yeah. Mary, how does it feel to fly? Was it difficult flying and singing at the same time in Peter Pan?
Oh, it was difficult learning, but it was not difficult doing it after it was accomplished. It was the most fun I've ever had in my life. We're doing it again, by the way.
You are?
Mm-hmm. We're going to do it at Christmas time on television.
Television.
And I look forward to it.
Well, it was certainly a wonderful performance that you did on television this last time. And I bet it was thrilling that the number of people that actually watched you.
Well, you know what was one of the biggest thrills that I've had about Peter Pan? We'd been away for 2 months. And we were on a freighter. And when we came back, I got off the freighter, and all these darling men on the docks, what do you call them, stevedores?
Yes, stevedores.
Said, "Peter Pan, how are you? How nice to see you," you know. And it wasn't Mary Martin, it was Peter Pan.
Yeah.
And they all thanked me personally for bringing Peter Pan into their homes for their children. One man brought out a $10 bill and said, "Would I
autograph it. And I said, not a $10 bill. He said, that means something to my child. With that, the next one came up and said, here's a $50 bill. And I said, I couldn't. And he said, oh, yes, this is for my child. It was very, very thrilling.
I'll be done. Hmm. It just shows you how many people believe in fairies.
Well, it shows you how many people have a nice soft spot their children. And that was the nicest thing, compliment to me. It was such a thrill.
I have a place where dreams are born and time is never planned. It's not on any chart. You must find it with your heart. Never, never land. It might be miles beyond the moon, or right there where you stand. Just keep an open mind, and then suddenly you'll find. Never, never land. You'll have a treasure if you stay there, more precious far than gold. For once you have found your way there, you can never, never grow old. And that's my home where dreams are born and time is never planned. Just think of lovely things, and your heart will fly on wings forever in never, never land.
Peter Pan, will you teach me how to fly? First I must blow the fairy dust on you.
Now come with me where dreams are born and time is never planned. Just think of lovely things and your heart will fly on wings forever in never.
Thank you, Mary Martin and Helen Hayes, for taking Monita backstage. Our best wishes to you all for a triumphant Paris performance.
During the next hour, Monitor will bring you the latest news with a report from Washington and London. We'll hear from Victor Borger and Lewis Bromfield, from Eddie Fisher, a report from Bob Hope in Australia. We'll go to Chicago for the Souter Finnegan Orchestra, to Paris for Art Buchwald and Gregory Rathoff, and lots more on Monitor.
This is Monitor, the new NBC radio service.
Monitor with